History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
This call is being recorded.
Listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
It's all right to talk about long white robes over yonder in all of its symbolism, but ultimately people want some suits and dresses and shoes to wear down here. It's all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey, but God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem, but one day, God's preacher must talk about the New New York, the new Atlanta, the new Philadelphia, the new Los Angeles, the new Memphis, Tennessee. This is what we have to do. Now, the other thing we'll have to do is this. Always anchor our external direct action with the power of economic withdrawal. Now, we are poor people. Individually, we are poor when you compare us with white society in America. We are poor. Never stop to get that collectively, that means all of us together, collectively we are richer than all the nations in the world with the exception of nine. Did you ever think about that? After you leave the United States, Soviet Russia, Great Britain, West Germany, France, and I can name others, the American Negro collectively is richer than most nations of the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. Did you know that? That's power right there if we know how to pool it. We don't have to argue with anybody. We don't have to curse and go around acting bad with our words. We don't need any bricks and bottles. We don't need any Molotov cocktails. We just need to go around to these stores and to these massive industries in our country and say, God sent us by here to say to you that you're not treating his children right. And we come by here to ask you to make the first item on your agenda fair treatment where God's children are concerned. Now, if you are not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you. So as a result of this, we're asking you tonight to go out and tell your neighbors not to buy Coca-Cola in Memphis. Go by and tell them not to buy sealed test milk. Tell them not to buy, what is all the bread? Wonder Bread. And what is other bread come to Jesse? Tell them not to buy Hart's bread. As Jesse Jackson has said, up to now, only the garbage men have been feeling pain. Now we must kind of redistribute the pain. We are choosing these companies because they haven't been fair in their hiring policies. And we are choosing them because they can begin the process of saying they are going to support the needs and the rights of these men who are on strike. And then they can move on town, downtown, and tell Mayor Loeb to do what is right. And not only that, we've got to strengthen black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the banks downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We want a bank-in movement in Memphis. Go by the Savings and Loan Association. I'm not asking you something that we don't do ourselves in SCLC. Judge Hooks and others will tell you that we have an account here in the Savings and Loan Association from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We are telling you to follow what we are doing. Put your money there. You have six or seven black insurance companies here in the city of Memphis. Take out your insurance there. We want to have an insurance in. Now, these are some practical things that we can do. We begin the process of building a greater economic base. And at the same time, we are putting pressure where it really hurts. And I ask you to follow through here. Now let me say, as I move to my conclusion, that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We've got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strap, but either we go up together or we go down together.
Hotep, and good afternoon, good evening, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. My name is William Rogers. And it is a pleasure and an honor, as always, to be with you here this evening. I am your host. Today we are going to talk about economics and Mother Africa. Economics and Mother Africa. We thank all of you, as always, for your patronage and your participation on this program. We look forward to being here every week and having an invigorating discussion with you about the various things that impact our community and that impact our people. So again, I thank you all for being here. This is a call-in format program. We have conversations. We have a wonderful host and guests sometimes that are a part of our dialogue, and you can also join us too each day. Our telephone number here is area code 215-490-9832. Again, I repeat, 215-490-9832. So if you have a question or you want to provide some dialogue, we welcome your call. And I think that you will find our discussion today to be a very invigorating one. We're going to play some sound clips for you to sort of explain this whole idea about the new global age that we live in, globalization, and what that means for African people, black African people throughout this world. And what does that mean? How do we need to position ourselves? What is it that we need to understand about globalization? We thank our great ancestor, the Honorable Martin Luther King, for his message there as he talked about some of the things that we can do on a small level in our communities. And I think that those are still valid, still relevant today. And that's a discussion that can be made in terms of that. But there are other things that I think we need to understand and position ourselves for. And the times are changing so fast that we have to be kept abreast. And so what we want to do here on the Black Reality Think Tank is to open up that dialogue and to see if we can provide some very clear understanding to our people about all of these things. As the great Marcus Garvey said, one race, one aim, and one destiny. And that is our motto. I just want to Also recognize the fact that we appreciate the opportunity to be on this network. This is the TimeForAnAwakening.com network, as well as the Black Talk Radio network. And as I said, we're here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. There's sometimes that we will play rebroadcasts and have them on, but most of the time we want to try to be on live. And then sometimes there are technical difficulties where we are unable to broadcast that particular day. This is internet radio, and so sometimes based on inclement weather and various things, it does stop us. Like right now, it's raining very heavily here in Bethonia, Georgia. It's sort of slacked up just a little bit now. We've had basically a very nice day up in the 80s, but it is raining, and I think there's a storm coming this way more. So nevertheless, we're going to go on with our agenda and talk about the economics of Mother Africa and our world in which we live in, and what that means and how we position ourselves as African people. I want to also mention that the Time for the Awakening Network and Black Talk Radio Network has other wonderful programs that air. I just want to mention a few of those so that you might want to go in and listen to those, or either go to the archive and hear some of those. All of our programs are archived. Our archive system, particularly for the Black Reality Think Tank right now, is under construction, under reconstruction. We hopefully will have that up and running in the next couple of weeks. But you can go on and listen to any program that we have. And we've had some dynamic ones in the last two or three weeks. Had Sister on last week, Nisiwa Ayan, talking about the whole system of trauma and stress and what that means and where that comes from and how it impacts us. Dynamic subject. And if you did not hear that, you can go back when the archive is prepared and listen to that. But also, there, this program, the Black Reality Think Tank, is sponsored by Motherland Media, and it is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. And so we are really pleased to have a partnership, a coalition that's working here to try to get the information out to you, our audience. On every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., dynamic discussion program as well called Africa Perspectives. And that program is hosted by my dear brother, Oshieme Adelabu. That's every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then on Monday evening at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., there's another program called Acres of Diamonds. Acres of Diamonds, every Monday evening, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And then on Monday evening as well, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., there's a program called Let's Buy Black 365. Let's Buy Black 365, Monday evenings, 8 p.m. To 9 p.m. And then on Tuesday, as you know, the Black Reality Think Tank with hosts, myself, Dr. William Rogers, every Tuesday from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern. And these are all Eastern times as well. And then on Wednesday, tomorrow, along with African Perspectives in the morning, in the evening, there's a program called Revive. And that program is hosted by Proof of Consciousness, POC, and that program airs on Wednesdays from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Friday, Brother Elliot, who is the director for Time for an Awakening Network System, Brother Elliot comes on with Brother Richard, and they have a program called Time for an Awakening. Dynamic discussion, guests, very, very dynamic guests, well-known people from throughout the African world come on and talk about various subjects. And that program is aired on Fridays from 8 p.m. To 10 p.m., from 8 p.m. To 10 p.m. And then on Saturday, Sports Talk, with Brother Troy Wilmore That program airs 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday, Sports Talk. And then Revive returns again on Sunday morning from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., which is Proof of Conscious, but hosted by Proof of Conscious. And that's Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then in the evening, Sunday evening, after you all settle in and had your nice Sunday dinner, time for an awakening again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And that the program is on from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., time for an awakening. And again, as I said, you can listen to them by simply going to www.timeforanawakening.com or either call area code 215-490-9832, and you can listen via telephone. So we do encourage you to participate with these programs. I think that you will clearly find them enjoyable. Every week we like to do an ancestral profile. That's a part of our introductory format. And today we're going to take a look at a very powerful African brother by the name of Kwame Nkrumah, professor and leader Kwame Nkrumah. Brother Nkrumah was born on September 1909 on the Gold Coast of Africa, which is now called Ghana. And he died on April 27, 1972. And he died in Bucharest, Romania. Ghanaian, he was a powerful Ghanaian nationalist leader who led Ghana to their independence from Britain and presided over its emergence as the new nation of Ghana. As I said previously to that, it was called the Gold Coast. He headed this country from independence in 1957 until he was overthrown by a coup in 1966. Kwame Nkrumah's father was a goldsmith, and his mother was a retail trader. He was baptized a Roman Catholic, and Nkrumah spent 9 years at the Roman Catholic Elementary School in nearby Assini, Africa. After graduation from college in 1930, Achebota College in 1930, he started his career as a teacher at a Roman Catholic junior school in Elmina and Axum, and at a seminary in Africa as well. Increasingly, he was drawn into politics, and Nkrumah decided to pursue further studies in the United States. He earned his degree from Lincoln University in Pennsylvania in 1935, and after graduating in 1939, he obtained a master's degree from Lincoln and from the University of Pennsylvania. He studied literature of socialism. He was very impressed with the philosophy, teachings of Karl Marx and Lenin, and of nationalism, especially that of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. He described himself as a non-denominational Christian and a Marxist socialist. He also immersed himself in political work. He was reorganizing and becoming president of the African Students Organization of the United States and Canada. He left the United States in 1945 and went to England, where he organized the 5th Pan-African Congress in Manchester. Meanwhile, in the Gold Coast, which, as I said now, is Ghana, there was an individual by the name of J.B. Dankwa, who had formed the United Gold Coast Convention, the UGCC. And he formed this to work for self-government by constitutional means. Brother Nkrumah was invited to serve as the UGCC General Secretary. Nkrumah returned home in late 1947 as the General Secretary. He addressed meetings throughout the Gold Coast and began to create a mass base for the new movement. When extensive riots occurred in February of 1948, the British briefly arrested Nkrumah and other leaders of the UGCC. Then there was a split developed between the middle-class leaders of the UGCC and the more radical supporters of Nkrumah. He formed in June of 1949 something called the New Convention People's Party, the CPP. It was a mass-based party that was committed to a program of immediate self-government. In January of 1950, Nkrumah initiated a campaign of positive action involving nonviolent protests, strikes, and non-cooperation with the British colonial authorities. In that ensuing crisis, services throughout the country were disrupted, and Nkrumah was again arrested and sentenced to 1 year's imprisonment. But the Gold Coast's first general election, which was on February 8, 1951, demonstrated the support the CPP had already won. He was elected to Parliament. Nkrumah was released from prison to become leader of the government business, and in 1952, he became the Prime Minister of the Gold Coast. When the Gold Coast and the British Togoland Trust Territory became an independent state within the British Commonwealth, it became known as Ghana. In March 1957, Nkrumah became the new nation's first prime minister. In 1958, Nkrumah's government legalized the imprisonment without trial of those it regarded as security risks. It soon became apparent that Nkrumah's style of government was to be authoritarian, but Nkrumah was popular in the country, and his popularity rose. However, as the new roads and schools and health facilities were built, and as the policy of the Africanization created better career opportunities for Ghanaians, his popularity even went further. By a plebiscite of 1960, Ghana became a republic, and Nkrumah became its president, with wide legislative and executive powers under a new constitution. Nkrumah then concentrated his attention on campaigning for the political unity of Black Africa, and he began to lose touch with the sort of the realities in Ghana, some said. His administration became involved in magnificent but often major destructive development projects, so that a once prosperous country became crippled with foreign debt. His government's second development plan, announced in 1959, had to be abandoned in 1961 when the deficit in the balance of payments rose to more than $125 million. Economy contracts led to widespread labor unrest and to a general strike in September of 1961. From that time, Nkrumah began to evolve a much more rigorous apparatus of political control and to turn increasingly to the communist countries for support. There was an attempted assassination of Nkrumah at Kulugungu in August of 1962, the first of several. It led to his increasing seclusion from public life and to the growth of a personality cult, as well as to a massive buildup of the country's internal security forces. Early in 1964, Ghana was officially designated a one-party state, with Nkrumah as life president of both nation and party. While the administration of the country passed increasingly into the hands of self-serving and corrupt party officials, Nkrumah busied himself with the ideological education of a new generation of Black African political activists. Meanwhile, the economic crisis in Ghana worsened, and the shortages of foodstuffs and other goods became chronic. So May 24, 1966, while Nkrumah was visiting Beijing, China, the army and the police in Ghana seized power. Returning to West Africa, Nkrumah found asylum in Guinea, where he spent the remainder of his life. He died of cancer in Budapest in 1972. Kwame Nkrumah. Okay, my brothers and sisters, we chose Brother Nkrumah because we wanted to talk about African leadership. One of the very interesting things that one should do sometime is to just take a look at various maps. Map examination and map study sometimes reveals some very interesting realism that you don't normally get by just looking at the paper or maybe looking at a history book. And so when you pick up a map, for instance, of Africa, or even the world, and you begin to look at its economic resources, you are forced to ask yourself the question, how in the world could a country with this much resources, with this much power, that owns every mineral right that the world needs, could be struggling in poverty? Just how is that possible? That's a real question that I think we have to ask. And I know that people can say, well, I know why. They did it because the Europeans came in and colonialism and blah, 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 and slavery. But it's got to go deeper than that. Now, you got to look at understanding the whole idea of setting an agenda and how do you do that and what reference point do you use in setting your agenda. That's one question you have to consider. Yes, and obviously you consider the outside world, but you got to kind of also look at it like we, for instance, cannot stop. Let's take, for instance, your home. You can't stop sometimes pests and different things from entering into your house. But what you do is you build up a defense system. You go out and you hire exterminators and you hire insecticides and different things that you can use to combat that. And you fight it. And you create a system to fight it. You keep your house a little cleaner so it doesn't draw them. You don't spill crumbs and leave crumbs on the floor. One of the biggest major problems a lot of times in the urban cities is roaches and rodents. And a lot of times, you know, we could get mad at the rodents and get mad at the roaches, but a lot of times it's our own fault. We are drawing them to our homes. We are not preparing ourselves to keep them away and doing some of those kinds of things. I think that analogy has to go also into this, looking at this world system. You've got every mineral that it takes to create anything that this world needs in that continent, on that continent. And basically, we have never controlled any of it throughout history. The Nigerians, yes, they have the oil wells, but they have the oil wells because the British were there. And the fact is that you have to have somebody to sell that oil to. They can't sell it to the Nigerians, so they have to sell it to the world. And the world has to be receptive that they will buy from them. And so there has to be a network or system created so that the Nigerians can sell that oil, or else it becomes useless. And that's the same with any the other products that Africa possesses. South Africa was very clearly one of the greatest sources of resources, and immediately the British and the Dutch and all of them went into South Africa and seized the Jewish, the Israelis went into Israel, went into South Africa, and they conquered it and kept the people imprisoned under a very harsh and cruel system. And so when you look at those kinds of things, and then you look at the numbers, the Belgians and how they went into the Congo, and the Congo is super rich with everything that you could possibly need. How was it that they were not able to stop the Belgians? You know, just based on pure raw numbers. How was that done? What is the process? What's the thinking? How could the Rwandans, the Tutu and the Hutus, turn on each other that way and live yet still in so much poverty and allow themselves to be manipulated by outsiders where they out killing their brothers and killing their families? The Biafra Wars of Nigeria, how did all of that happen in such a way of destruction? The transatlantic slave trade. Now, we know that Africans fought back. We know that. We know very clearly that they did that. But still, there has got to be a question and an explanation that we as African people come up with is how could that have happened? Just based on some factors, outside the factors, or I'm sorry, inside factors that we were in control of. How could that be? Because if, and see, the reason why this is important, if you can't answer that question, then what happens is you leave it to the Darwinian philosophers to answer it. And they start coming up with stuff like survival of the fittest and all of that, which is a bunch of mess. You know better than that. And I think one of the best examples is the animal kingdom, the animal world outside of the humans, the animal world. And Africa has the largest conglomerate of animals that, you know, we can take a look at. I always think about the lion, call him the king of the jungle, controls and dominates. Up to a certain point, he encounters those hyenas and they will back up. You know, they're not all that, you know, and the hyenas have their weapon system. Lions have their weapon system. The tiger, the cheetah has it. The panther has it, you know. And they do buy for food because food, clothing, shelter is the driving force. So those are the things that I wanted to put on the table this evening to talk about, because at some point, this has to be answered for the future. The younger generation comes up. There has to be a leadership that's trained to understand the dynamics of how that works. As we heard in the biography of Nkrumah, a lot of how that ascension, and probably a lot of it was manipulated from outside, but he was a powerful neo-colonialist. He was a Pan-Africanist. He had the right viewpoints, but for some reason, the winds that blow through the political arena have the tendency to disrupt if you are not prepared. So I think that's something that we have to look at, and that's what I want to kind of talk about tonight. I have a couple of clips where the African leaders themselves are talking about what the problem is. A lot of it is not just blamed on the outside. They've got to look at it inside, just like our community. You know, the people selling drugs in our community are not most of white folks. They are our own people. That's who's doing the killing a lot of times and the crimes. I mean, they do it too. But, you know, some of that's at our helm. We have to address that. How do we stop that? How do you stop drug dealers from selling kids drugs near your schools? What is it that you do? What do you put in place? What are you doing? The political arena and the politicians, the outsiders, will do what we say do. Because then you go to the Martin Luther King approach, and if you don't, then we do some other things that tighten up the grips that are sometimes on our community. And we have to do that. And so I think those are questions that we've got to ask. There are no clear answers, obviously, but we got to ask those questions, and we got to ask the hard ones. You know, how do outsiders come into our community and control it? How do we allow Arab stores to open up all over our community, selling us junk and garbage that they won't eat, messing with our young girls, doing all kind of things, and we don't do anything? How is it that the Asians were able to come in and take over a major product that has always been a source of economic power for African Americans, and that is the control of our hair? Barbershops, beauty salons, historically, have always been very powerful economic entity. I don't know any poor barbers. I don't know any beauticians who are poor. They, when I say poor, I mean who are in dire poverty. I mean, they obviously struggle like the rest of us, you know, pay their bills and do things like that. But they have a steady income, and they are able to feed their families and to do some things the best that they can. But how do we come in and let the Asians take over the trade that's needed to produce that business? How did we do that? When we had a Madam C.J. Walker, when we had the Bonner Brothers, when we had some of these other hair care product companies that were very powerful, Johnson product, what happened? We've got to ask that, and we've got to ask it now because we haven't answered it. You know, we all might have our thoughts all while, but we don't. And very clearly, Africa is the beginning area of examining, because what you see going on in Africa is the same thing that's going on in our community. And I think that that's something that all of us need to address. We need to address it to our children. We need to address it in our educational system and things like that. One of my favorite African scholars, one of the ones who was doing some great work in talking about some of the challenges in Africa, is a brother by the name of P.L.O. Lumumba. And Brother Lumumba has been a very strong vocal voice. He recently had a meeting with several African leaders from different coalitions, the South African, the West African, those in East Africa, Ethiopia, the Sudan, down in Durban, South Africa, down in that area, Mozambique, North Africa. He met with a whole collection of them, even the current Libyan government, and he talked about just what I'm talking about now. And so I want us to take a few minutes and listen to this, and then after that we're going to come back, and I want to kind of open up the line because I've got some very dynamic people on the online now that also are talking can talk about this. But I want to just look at it. I want to look at this whole idea of this globalization. That's the buzzword. By the way, there's a great book by a guy named Culprin, C-U-L-P-R-I-N. It's called The Political Economy of International Relations. And that's a dynamic book that he explains. What he does, though, is explain globalization and the idea of globalization, what it means, where it came from, what brought it into action, so forth. And he's not obviously talking about it from in a nationalistic perspective. But at least it's a start for just basic information. And it's mostly used in a textbook, as a textbook in most economic classes in universities and colleges. But it's an excellent read to provide a better understanding of the whole globalization process and what happened. For instance, understanding the onslaught of the new technology. Computers and what it has done, and social media, and the new onset of transportation systems, and how sophisticated they have come, and how that helps to aid in the creation of global economy. But nevertheless, let's hear what an African brother, his name is P.L.O. Lumumba. He's just trying to talk about it a little bit. And he's suggesting to these African leaders, and there were about 50 of them in the room, and he's suggesting to them that you must define your own agenda and not let your, just because somebody's giving you a couple of million dollars, let them define it for you. You don't do that. You define it. And he's saying some very dynamic things. So let's listen to my brother, and then when we come back, open up the lines and comment about that, and then we're going to go to some other clips. I want to hear the new Ghanaian premier, prime minister, and what he says about the European when the French prime minister came to Ghana and wanted to talk to him, and he put him in his place, and he said it's going to be a new agenda, my friend. We're not going to play the way we played before. And so I want to hear that conversation as well. But let's listen to P.L.O. Lumumba.
Let me enter into this conversation by giving a historical context. In the month of May 1963, the leaders of the then independent African countries assembled in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And many speeches were delivered, and the thrust of all the speeches was that African countries, having regained their independence, their primary focus and objective was to ensure that they exercised their regained mandate for the benefit of the people, to ensure that the people were liberated from ignorance disease, and poverty. On the 24th day of May, perhaps the most powerful speech ever made by an African leader was delivered by Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah. And he reminded the leaders who were present on that day about a number of things. One, he told them that not to delude themselves, that by regaining their independence, the erstwhile colonizer would recoil and remain inactive. That in fact, the erstwhile colonial master was going to be more pernicious, but in a very subtle way. Kwame Nkrumah was right. He reminded his audience that going forward, it was necessary and indeed urgent that Africans should begin to think as one whole, because if they remained in disunity, they would remain weak and vulnerable and therefore susceptible to manipulation. Kwame Nkrumah was right. He reminded his audience that because many of, if not all of the African countries were artificial, they were created in Berlin, and the boundaries were artificial. But he urged his audience that they should respect the inviolability of the boundaries, because if they tried to redraw the boundaries, conflict would never end. And that was reinforced in 1964 in Cairo on the doctrine of inviolability of inherited boundaries. I remind us of this particular incident 58 years ago because in 2013, the African Union came with Agenda 2063. And if you look at the text of Agenda 2063 and the speeches that were given around it, it was the rehash of what Kwame spoke about and the other leaders spoke about. And it's not lost on me last year that one of the themes of African Union was the silencing of the guns by the year 2020. I'm not a Jewish prophet, but the guns will not be silent next year. In fact, there are more guns that are emerging in Africa, which means that peace is still very elusive. And then we have been given the history. The founding fathers of the African countries took the view that because we are states made out of many nations, there was wisdom in having a style of politics that was different. So that in the early days of many African countries, many leaders held the view, whether they were mistaken or not is another debate for another day. But they held the view that one of the things that they had to do was to have single party states, so that if you went to Zaire then, or Congo before it became Zaire, or Zambia, or Malawi, or Kenya, or Uganda, or Tanzania, everybody believed that in order to hold the many nationalities together, you needed a single party under whose aegis organization of state affairs would be undertaken. Mistakes were made. And then the conceptual West convinced us that our salvation could only come from something they call democracy. And I'm using the word very deliberately, something they call democracy, which they defined. And they defined it in English, if you are colonized by the English. And they defined it in French, if you are colonized by the French. And they defined it in Portuguese, if you are colonized by the Portuguese. And they defined it in Spanish, if you are colonized by the Spaniard. We never defined it in Kinyarwanda. No. It was never defined in Igbo or Yoruba. And we were told after the collapse of the Soviet Union that democracy was equals to, one, multi-party politics, two, periodic elections, 3, limitation of terms of the presidency. That is how the conceptual West defined it for us. And we who have had the advantage, if it is an advantage at all, of being educated in the West, there is a sense in which our thought processes are also confined by those definitions. However much we want to free ourselves, we find our default mode being how we were trained. So when we define democracy, we are also caught up in this box. Sometimes we tell ourselves to think outside of the box, but the true north of our thought processes still remains the box. We never think without the box. So when we talk about peace in Africa, and we talk about adversarial politics, we are not talking about anything that is African. The political party is not African. It is something that we inherited. You know, in the United Kingdom, they talk about the loyal opposition, loyal to the monarchy. Because there is a process. Permit me to say at this stage that Africa deals with diversity much better than Europe. Much better. If you look at your typical European nation, the Dutch is the Dutch, largely. The Swedes are the Swedes, largely. The Norwegians are the Norwegians, largely. The Finns are the Finns, largely. And where they have many ethnicities, they don't do very well. Ask the Spaniards if you doubt me. Where they had many nations in Yugoslavia, ask them. They created many nations to create pure ethnicities. But African nations have succeeded thus far in working with diversity in very unique circumstances where the conceptual West, despite their protestation to the contrary, are always interfering in our affairs in a very subtle manner. When we are holding election, they will deny it. But there is a way in which they are always moving in a subterranean fashion. Because the thesis still is that you divide them in order to rule them. That is the thesis. We don't say it as loudly as we should because we want to be politically correct, and I refuse to be correct. And this is exactly what Kwame Nkrumah warned us about. And the political party therefore lends itself to that manipulation. We will be persuaded, because it is us who have gone to school who form political parties, we'll be persuaded to form outfits. And in many African countries, these outfits are formed on the basis of ethnic affiliation. Your typical African political party is simply an assembly of ethnicities. And in many African nations, you will discover that what we call elections is simply an ethnic census to determine which ethnic group is larger than the other. It is Julius Nyerere of Tanzania who said it. He said that the tragedy of Africa is not what the song is, not the song that is being sung, but who the singer is. And what he meant was very clear, that you may have an agenda that is good for your nation, but if you do not come from a particular ethnic group, those who will follow you will not be from your ethnic group. You may sing the best song, but when you look back, you'll discover that it's only people from your ethnic group who are following you. And when you have such a situation, the design is inherently conflictual. And that is why, therefore, when you look at Africa today, you discover that after every election cycle in many African countries, there is conflict. Because you go into the election, or the political parties go into an electoral process on the basis that we must win, and if we don't win, the elections have been rigged. In other words, we place so much premium on the presidency, and you'll see in many African countries, entry into government is like winning a lottery. It is winning a lottery because it gives you access to resources. And therefore, people claim the president. If you are in a country, say, and one of your own means a son, they are normally sons. One of your own sons has won the presidency. The tribe celebrates from the herdsman to the professor. from the fisherman to the intellectual, because we have now won the presidency, we have won the lottery, we will have ministers, we'll have all these, and everybody else feels excluded, and that generates conflict. And we have seen it, whether if we don't see it in Gabon, we see it in Guinea-Bissau. If we don't see it in Guinea-Bissau, we see it in Kenya. If we don't see it in Kenya, we see it in South Sudan. So that in South Sudan, if one were to ask them, what is the problem? The contest is of an ethnic kind. They are contesting because one of our own must occupy the state house. And that is why, therefore, you see, under the guise of democracy in a number of African countries, we create offices which are sinecures. You will have a president, you'll have a deputy president, you'll have a second deputy president, you'll have a prime minister, first prime minister, first second prime, all those useless offices which make no sense, because you have to appoint people into those offices and give them a motorcade so that when they go to their villages, they look important and the people own them as ours. People want to be included. In such a scenario, my verdict is, number one, Africa's long-term salvation demands that we avoid adversarial politics. Africa's salvation demands that we define for ourselves what democracy means. And you said it very correctly, Professor, and the good friend from the United Kingdom, very correctly. What people want is to participate. What people want is to have a government that is accountable. Many people in many African countries simply want food on the table. Many people in many African countries simply want to have access to health care. Many people simply want good education. Young men and women in Africa simply want opportunities for innovation and invention. And they want a government that creates an environment where that can be achieved. And therefore, in my view, I think the time has come that Africa must define herself. One of the problems that we have in Africa is that we do not define ourselves. And permit me to annoy you. In many African nations today, after every election, whether we like it or not, we have observers. And when the elections are being held, observers may come from Nigeria, from Kenya, from Uganda, but people are waiting. What did the European Union say? You know, this belief by us that the Europeans have a divine duty to tell us what to do, and we have a divine duty to accept to do what they say, is one of the problems that we have. And until the day that we liberate ourselves to decolonize our minds, in a manner of speaking, we are going to embrace the kind of politics that will only perpetuate conflict. Right now, as I move towards my conclusion, I simply want you to look at the map of Africa. And look at the map of Africa against the declaration that the guns might be silenced by 2020. And simply tell me, is there peace and calm in Niger? Is there peace and calm in Burkina Faso? Do you have peace and calm in Mali? Is it peaceful in Mauritania? Is it peaceful in Benin? Is it peaceful in Gabon? Is it peaceful in Cameroon? Is it peaceful in South Sudan? Is it peaceful in the Democratic Republic of Congo? Is it peaceful in Somalia? You look at the map of Africa and you look at that, and you are being told through declarations that we are going to silence the guns in 2020. It's as if you are being told to go to Kigali, and meanwhile, you have engaged a gear taking you to the Democratic Republic of Congo's border, and you are on jet-like speed. This is why I think that it is incumbent upon us to remember one thing, that peace is not merely the absence of war. It is much deeper than that. That development is not building of skyscrapers in African cities, no. And that therefore, if we want to sustain peace and development, what we must look at are the human indices. I think the Bhutanese have got it right. They what they call the gross national happiness index. These things that Europe tells us many useful things, but there are certainly useless things that they tell us. One of them is the thing called per capita income, that they take all the wealth, half of which is owned by two people, and then they divide it and say the per capita income is $800. And meanwhile, all other people are suffering. I'm submitting to us that time has come that we must define what development is. I want to go to a typical Rwandese village, and beyond peace, beyond the absence of war, I want to see peace at the dinner table. I want to see peace at the hospital and the dispensary. And I'm suggesting to us that politics defines all these. And one of the things that we must do, and Professor, I can't agree with you more, is that there is no one size fits all. There is no one size fits all. What works for Rwanda is not necessarily what works for Uganda. In 1984, the Ethiopians came up with a constitution which I think is the only one in the world that allows, that defines itself on the basis of ethnic identity and even allows the ethnicities to secede under certain conditions. Whether it has worked or not, I think the jury is still out. But they recognize the fact that ethnicities are real. And if we continue to delude ourselves in Africa that ethnicities are unreal, we are cheating ourselves. Even the United States of America nowadays, when you hear them talking about the vote, they talk about the Hispanic vote. They talk about the black vote. They talk about the Caucasian vote. They are beginning to recognize that those blocks are critical. How then do you use them in a manner that is positive? Because look at the Democratic Republic of Congo with over 233 ethnicities. Look at Nigeria with over 200 languages. Look at Kenya with over 56. Look at Tanzania with 136 plus. These are the realities in the African nation. And I am convinced that going forward, number one, we need to have peace. But we will not have peace by declaring that peace will come and reign. We must do things that move us in the direction of attaining peace. And until we introduce what I've called elsewhere hygiene in our politics, we are moving nowhere. And part of the introduction of hygiene is to recognize the environment and the context in which we operate. One of the areas in which we must move is to recognize that going forward, we are different nations in single states trying to create mega nations. And unless we have inclusivity so that people belong, feel they belong. And I want to give this example. In Kenya, it happens, and I believe in other countries. When an individual is elected as a member of parliament, in many African countries, they have things they call homecoming parties. These homecoming parties is an attempt to demonstrate to the village by the newly elected member of parliament or newly appointed minister that we went to hunt. We have come back with a prize. That prize is membership in parliament or a ministerial post. Let us eat and celebrate. So that when you want to punish that individual, you are not punishing the holder of the office, but you are punishing the whole village. People own these positions. And I'm suggesting to us that politics must be of such a nature that allows ethnicities and groups to negotiate. I do not as yet have an answer which I think I can pin on the ground, but I have the following things. That it cannot be uniform. That it must be specific to the circumstances of each country, that it is us who must define it, and that we must have a vocabulary for it, and that we must warn ourselves that the erstwhile colonial master is alive and well. Subterranean and pernicious to the core, don't delude yourselves. And remember that sometimes the disunity of Africa is big business. And if we forget that, we will once again be manipulated. Lastly, I saw the African National Congress winning an election in South Africa last week. Not that it is a bad thing, but somebody sent me a clip that was very telling. It was a clip where all the celebrants were Chinese, and they were celebrating, "Hail African National Congress Chinese" in Johannesburg. That laughter suggests to me that you have understood my message.
God bless you.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
As I indicated, brothers and sisters, that speech was delivered before about 50 African leaders, both political and military leaders. And I tell you, it was representative of all of the continent. And if they listened to that with any depth and merit, you can see very clearly why all of those resources in Africa do not provide income and do not provide opportunities for African people. And they'll also see that there's some work that they have to do. They have to begin to rebuild using some of the ideas that Professor Lumumba offered. And he brought that, as I said, as he started off with the historical context. These were some of the same things that Nkrumah wanted to do. And Julius Nyerere, he also wanted to do. Thomas Sankara, he wanted to do. And very clearly, a lot of the bitterness, inner fighting that happens there was taking place. One of the things you got to understand, and then I want to open up, one of the things that you got to understand is who Africa is dealing with. It's the same thing that we're dealing with in our communities. The same problems in Africa, it's the same problems in our community. There's a lot of bickering and fighting among each other. We can't get anything done. A lot of our institutions that we look forward to doing things is not coming forward. The black church, the black political structure, none of that is happening. So it's sort of a duplication of the same thing that's going on in the continent. And so the question becomes, how do we wake up and change that and see that that's causing problems? Because who we are dealing with in terms of a lot of times of our enemy, we're dealing with gangsters. We're dealing with a gangster culture. We're dealing with a culture that believes that right and liberty and justice is at the barrel of a gun. And they are prepared to use that to enforce their way of life. So if you don't want to do what they want you to do in the way that they want you to do it, they will either use their gun or either they'll withdraw whatever resources we have decided to take from them and depend upon. They'll pull those away from you. And then you are forced to crumble and look for crumbs to make it. We've got to be prepared to give up something. Sacrifice. I've learned that based on old age. One of the things I've learned, and the major things that I've learned in old age, is that you've got to be able to sacrifice. You've got to be able to give up something. See, a lot of times we don't want to turn stuff loose, and that's going to kill you, and that's going to destroy you. So I think one of the things, once you consider, as I said, you have to consider that we're dealing with gangsters. You're not dealing with political government kinds of authority. You're dealing with crooks. You're dealing with the godfather mentality. And you're dealing with things like that. They control a lot of our industry. It's being controlled from the outside in that way. And so when we encounter them, we encounter their police officers. They're part of that same thing. That's why we get so shocked when we hear some of the crazy stuff they're doing. Well, they're gangsters. They're part of a gangster culture. That's what they're programmed to do, go out and kill anybody that's an adversary or doesn't do it the way I want you to do it. I'll kill you. And so we got to think about that, talk about that, find ways to deal with it and kind of look at it. And that's the global order right now. That's the new world global order. That's what, we say, we hear so much about. Let me open up the lines and hear what some of our brothers. I haven't talked to this brother in a while. He hadn't been on the air with us in a while, but I'm glad he's back on. Brother Pugh, what were your thoughts on PLO Lumumba's message to those African leaders?
Well, I think he was absolutely brilliant. I think that his message is the most succinct description of the problematic of change that people face all over the world. Mm-hmm. I think that that message needs to be the beginning of any discussion of anybody talking about politics.
Right.
He covers all of the questions and he raises all the issues.
Yeah,
and so on. So I mean, absolutely brilliant. I mean, this notion that when he talks about adversarial politics, when he talks about our sort of uncritical acceptance of ideals from Europe, his notion that African people had a better sense of democracy than Europeans had. When he tells us that, you know, there's 200 Nigerian languages and thousands of ethnicities in the Congo, these are people who are able to coexist with each other, which is something the Europeans, the only way they could coexist was the annihilation of difference. African people have demonstrated the ability to coexist with difference. And so on. In other words, I can go on and on and on. This is rich. This is this is it, man. This is the story. This needs to. In other words, what I'm saying. See, the problem is actually there are a couple other things I mentioned.
Okay.
First of all, one of the things that I just got through reading today, I was reading Salon magazine, and it was an article by a fellow that says, "Why do conservatives hate Oberlin? You know, Oberlin College in Ohio, right?" And he couldn't understand why they hated Oberlin. Well, it turns out that what he was talking to was the same thing that Professor Lumumba was talking about when he says these high-stakes politics where you've got to win because they're winner-take-all, right? And he says that comes from this adversarial politics. Well, the reason that conservatives hate Oberlin, and now, by the way, you said something, and you know, all this is related. When you talked about them being a gangster, they haven't always been a gangster. This is an ideology that they've developed. And one of the best ways of describing it is the Nazi legal theorist,
right,
Carl Schmitt,
right.
Who says that politics comes before culture. So what Professor Lumumba is trying to tell us is that culture comes before politics. That is to say that I can recognize that you come from a different people than me, but that doesn't make you automatically my enemy. What Carl Schmitt, the German theorist, was telling them, and the reason that conservatives hate Oberlin University is because they don't believe that. They believe, they've been taught to believe, that is, that anybody who's different than you is your enemy. In fact, their category is you either my friend or you're my foe,
right?
That's their logic, and so on. And by the way, I could go on and on, so I'm going to shut up because really the best thing for me to do is absorb what this show, because as I said, he said it all.
He sure did.
To absorb that, and then because I think any coherent response really has to address what he says. But one of the things, just to say briefly about adversarial politics, one of the problems with adversarial politics is just like, you know, we talked about winner take all. We talked about might makes right, you know, the kind of gangster rule.
Right.
Well, one of the things about adversarial politics, and we see it, you know, in our courtrooms, you know, the adversarial legal system,
right,
where it's not a question of what is true or what is false. In fact, if you've got an attorney with enough money and enough insight to get different evidence suppressed and, you know, to get the venue in the right place and with the right judge, well, you know, he can end up prevailing regardless of what the facts are. We see police every day shooting people, you know, choking people, killing people and whatnot, and it's all legitimate. So that's because in an adversarial system, if you've got the inferior legal team, you're going to lose regardless of what the facts are. You remember what they say, if you got the facts, argue the facts. If you got the law, argue the law, and if you have neither one of those, change the subject. Well, that's kind of what goes on. In any case, I can go on and on and on and
that's
on.
That's great. That's great.
Was absolutely
that.
Brilliant, but I'm going to shut up and let some other folks get in.
Okay. Brother Timothy, do you see, and I really want you to answer this question, do you see similarities in the struggles of our community with the struggles of Africa. Do you see some of that same similarities in terms of how things are operating?
You know what, brother? I'm happy I came on today. I'm going to say that for two reasons. One thing, because Ezekiel, I'm the Ezekiel, and the Kuma, and we're all Lincoln graduates.
Right.
And I was schooled with people from Nigeria and from Ghana.
Right.
And I'm also into politics. You know, I'm an educator, and I've ran for office. And I'm going to say this to you, that Nkrumah has been a hero for mine for years. And I'm saying that to say that people don't know, when he went to Lincoln University, his basic major was divinity. Early Lincoln, people wanted to get divinity degrees. Later, it became more of the several liberal arts. You started to do medicine, you started to do phys ed, you started to do math, you did things of that nature, biology, chemistry. They had a law school for about 4 years, and it wasn't in our charter, so they let it go. But my point was, from the Nkrumah experience, from leaving Lincoln and going to Penn, was Marcus Garvey.
Right.
That's where he got the idea that Africa must unite. See, the Nkrumah is the perfect example of a Lincoln man at that time, man. And I'm going to say this, that when we look at Nkrumah and we look at what was going on in the independence in the 60s and how things were transpiring and the African leaving Africa to be educated in America and going back to Africa, and that's how Lincoln was started, with two Liberians who co-founded it with John Miller Dickey. But let me get to my point. And that's how I started with the degree of divinity. But what Nkrumah is telling us, once he's in Africa and he's become the prime minister, and as he's progressing, what we're seeing in Africa is what's going on in America. In other words, he's dealing with the colonizer and we're dealing with segregation. And right now, today, in Philadelphia, with gentrification going on and the way that the police, matter of fact, I'm going to a protest Thursday, a city council, for what the police department have been using in the police department on Facebook. They're bold. They put them, I don't like Negroes, I don't like Muslims, I don't like gays, I don't like lesbians. They're killing you, right, with a black commissioner, sir.
Yeah.
They're doing what they want to do with a black commissioner. Now, my point is that what went on in Africa, what went on in Philadelphia and all in America, that the colonizer was controlling America, and white folks the colonizer control in Africa, this is really segregation, because this right here is populated more of a black people who whites in control. That's nothing but apartheid here.
That's true.
Now, right now, we have all the major offices are ran by black people. But white people are doing exactly what they want to do.
Right. That's right.
Now, the thing is that Elijah Muhammad said, but you let them come amongst you. How did he get there? And once he got there, how was he able to overtake you? You know what? At one time in the 60s, you couldn't get a gun in California when the parents was. They had broken up shotguns if they could get them. In Philadelphia, the BLA, they were spoiled on you. You can get a gun like it's nothing in Philadelphia, because you know why? We shoot each other with a gun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And guess what? The police are what? Look how they stopped that young lady and that young man. She's pregnant. Somebody else takes her baby. He spreads eagle. The guy says, you're not spread further enough. But I like what Jay-Z did, because he offered to help. That's what we got to do. That's how we get out of this, yeah. Mr. Pugh and Dr. Rogers. We have to help each other out of this. Because ain't nobody going to get us out of this but us.
I agree. All right, what I want to do now is I want to look at the Ghanaian prime minister and what he said. I think Mr. Pugh, he sent me this over earlier today. He's talking to the French prime minister who is inquiring about trying to have a better bonding and economic relationship with Ghana. And the Ghanaian prime minister said, you don't have no good relationship And it's not going to operate like that it has in the past. So let's kind of listen a little bit to his remark. It's not quite as long as PLO and Lumumba's, but let's listen to his remark.
Welcome to the Great African Leadership Series, where we feature great inspirational speeches and quotes from African leaders.
I think there is a fundamental misstatement of the issue in the question. We can no longer continue to make policy for ourselves, in our country, in our region, in our continent, on the basis of whatever support the Western world or France or the European Union can give us. It will not work. It has not worked, and it will not work. Our responsibility is to charter a path which is about how we can develop our nations ourselves. It is not right for a country like Ghana, 60 years after independence, to still have its health and education budgets being financed on the basis of the generosity and charity of European taxpayers. By now, we should be able to finance our basic needs ourselves. And if we are going to look at the next 60 years as a period of transition, a period whereby we can stand on our own feet, our perspective has not to be what the French taxpayer decides to do with whatever surpluses that they have in France. They're welcome. They are appreciated. Whatever interventions that the French taxpayer through their governments make to us are appreciated. We're not going to lick a gift horse in the mouth. But this continent, with all that has happened, is still today the repository of at least 30% of the most important minerals of the world. It's a continent of vast, arable, and fertile lands. It has the youngest population of any of the continents in the world. So it has the energy and the dynamism. We have seen it. These young men who are showing so much resilience and ingenuity in crossing the Sahara, finding ways to go across with rickety boats across the Mediterranean to really, those energies, we want to have those energies working inside our countries. And we're going to have those energies working in our countries if we begin to build systems that tell the young people of our country that their hopes, their opportunity are right here with us. Migration and the movement of people is being presented in a manner which suggests that somehow it's a new phenomenon. There's nothing new about it. It's as old as man, the movement of people. And it has always been linked to the same thing. The failure of where you are to provide you with an opportunity, so you move somewhere else. Those of you who are familiar with 19th century European history would know that the biggest wave of immigration in 19th century Europe, the latter part of it, came from Ireland and from Italy. Waves upon waves, generations of Italians and the Irish people left their countries to seek the American paradise, largely because Ireland was not working, Italy was not working. Today, you don't hear it. Italian young people are in Italy. Irish young people are in Ireland. We want young Africans to stay in Africa. And how are they? And it means that we have to get away from this mindset of dependence, this mindset about what can France do for us. France will do whatever it needs to do for its own sake. And when those coincide with ours, tant mieux, as the French people say. But our main responsibility as leaders, as citizens, is what we need to do to grow our own countries. What are the institutions that work that would allow us to have good governance, to have accountable governance, to make sure that the monies that are placed at the disposal of leaders are used for the interests of the state and not for those of the leaders, to have systems that allow for accountability. that allow for diversity, that allow for people to be able to express themselves and contribute to fashioning the public will and the public interest. Our concern should be with what do we need to do in this 21st century to move Africa away from being cap in hand and begging for aid, for charity, for handouts. The African continent, when you look at its resources, should be giving monies to other places. We have huge wealth on this continent. In our own country of Ghana. And we need to have a mindset that says, we can do it. Others have done it. We can also do it. And once we have that mindset, we will see it as a liberating factor for ourselves. We keep talking about how it was that Koreans, Malaysians, Singaporeans, who got their independence at the same time as us. We're told of that at the time of Ghanaian independence, per capita Ghanaian income was higher than that of Korea. Today, Korea is part of the first world. So is Malaysia. So is Singapore. What happened? Why did they make that transition? And 60 years after independence, we are where we are. Those are the matters that should concern all of us as Africans, as Ghanaians. And not, when I say so, with the greatest of respect to the French president, I think that the cooperation of France is something that I am, as you know, a strong friend of France. I am Francophile. So I don't have any difficulty with that. But I'm talking about our own propulsion, what we need to do to get our countries to work so that we can create the conditions that would allow our young people to forego this hazardous effort to get to Europe. They're not going there because they want to. They're going there because they don't believe they have any opportunities in our countries. So that should be our focus. And I believe that with that, that if we change that mindset of dependence, that mindset which is contingent on aid and charity, we would see that in the decades ahead of us, the full flowering of the African peoples will take place. And that new African personality that was talked about at the time of our independence will become real and imminent in our times. That's what I'm saying. I hope that I'm not upsetting the questioner or even some of my friends who are here. But these are my strongly held beliefs. And that is the reason why I've adopted as the slogan of my presidency, of my period of the Supreme Office of Ghana, that we want to build a Ghana beyond aid, a Ghana which is independent, which is self-sufficient, that is capable of standing on its own feet and building its own life. We can do it if we have the correct mindset to do so. Mr. President, those are my contributions.
Okay, Brother Marcus, how are you doing today? What you think?
Share this video with friends and family to support the channel.
Brother Marcus?
Yes.
How you doing?
Yes,
today?
Brother. I'm here, yes, brother. Good evening. Yes, you know, it's, you know, that President Adu there, he recently, I think he was in Jamaica and St. Vincent and Barbados recently. And in fact, they open up relationships now that Jamaica, you don't need a visa to go to Ghana. And Ghana don't need visa to come to Jamaica. And they're developing trade and stuff like that. They were talking about Gavi, the government now. This is the government talking, you know. So we see that dynamic taking place.
Right.
We also see that dynamic in Africa with the Africa Free Trade Agreement taking place.
Right.
Where they have decided, you know. So those are things that are promising for Africa. I think the challenge that we face here in the West is how do we come contributing to that in Africa and at the same time contributing, benefiting ourselves also. And you see, and I think one way we can do that is trade, because as you have said, in the same things that are affecting us and the international community affect us in our local communities. Other ethnic groups carting out the money out of the black community.
Right.
Right. It's the same thing is happening in Africa on a macro scale. In our community, local communities, there's a micro scale, right, which is the same thing. So how do we overthrow that? And I think one way to do it is trade. You know, cut them out, you know, direct trade. And I think that was what Garvey was pointing to when he started kind of getting those ships. And they said, nope. So we have to pick up from where Garvey left off.
Okay.
We have to get our thing in order. So look, okay, what we need, we say we want to connect with Africa. Okay, we're going to need ships. We're going to need maritime people.
Right.
How do we get the money to buy ships? How do we get the technical skills and the air to get, you know, and put those things in place and do the things, you know, that are necessary? Because we're going to need ships to move goods and services, as it, you know, if we're going to involve trade.
Right. That's exactly right.
Jamaica has maritime people they're training, you know, so they ain't got no jobs out there, you know, so we could connect, you know, with to get the skills from other places. So we have to get more critical, you know, and look outside of America. You know, yes, we fighting here, but I think we stand a better chance on the continent. We have to figure out a way we can use here to springboard. And another thing with that African free trade thing, they're going to need infrastructure in Africa. They're going to need technicians. They're going to need engineers. So we have to start to cultivate our youth here who have access to this technology. We got to find a way to capture their mind and sell them that vision. Say, look, you don't have to. You know, you can get your knowledge here and bring it someplace else.
Right.
We have to give our kids a different vision than this. See? So we have to create that image, that vision. To look, you know, get the skills here, you know, get whatever the equipment here, get the capital here, but we going to build there.
Right. There you go.
So that's my little contribution.
Right.
Thank you, good brother.
Yes, sir. You know, one of the things that many of the Garvey scholars, you know, who study Marcus Garvey, a lot of them study Nkrumah along with that. And there's a philosophical principle. I think it was done by Tony Martin, who has done a lot of work on Garvey, created something called fundamentalism. And the whole fundamentalist idea is that Garvey offers, you know, in terms of his philosophy and his teaching, he offers the fundamental factors that are needed by the African world for liberation. It's the fundamentals of it. And he definitely has touched these two brothers that we heard from today. Brother P.L.O. Lumumba and the Ghanaian leader. And so I think we in the community here in America, we have to begin to look at that in terms of our own programs and agendas and how we're trying to do things. So I think that's clearly the message here about Africa, and that's a step towards understanding, you know, why is it that, you know, those resources that Africa has are not under our control and are not being used for the benefit of our people and our families? I think that's a good starting lesson. There's more to it than that. It's got to get into a lot of deeper other areas. But I think that's a start that we can have in terms of doing that. And so very clearly, I think that's a starting point. We had Sister Ayan was on, and she got off. Maybe she'll come back on in a few minutes, see if she had some remarks to say. And a good brother from Atlanta, he was on. We spent a time. I wanted us to hear that PLO Lumumba piece because that's critical. And as Brother Pugh said, he addresses the whole thing. He addressed whatever we need to do. He's there. He's there in Africa. He lives in Africa. And he was talking to the heads of state that have are the ones that need to benefit this. So let me ask Brother Pugh, if you don't mind, James, let me come back to you again. What do you think are going to be the factors that will block this? Are they going to listen to that, do you think, based on some of those leaders that you know of? Somalia is clearly had a civil war going on for a long time. The Sudan, civil war. China is in the Sudan real heavily. They're extracting those minerals for medicinal purposes, and they're building their medicinal empire from all of that. Ghana, the Chinese are in Ghana, Chinese are in Nigeria. So what do you think? What do you think is the way to move to what Lumumba is trying to offer?
Well, you know, he actually addressed that specifically when he talked about Nkrumah's warning that just because you're independent don't mean that these colonial forces would be gone. Mm-hmm. And so you have to recognize that whatever you're doing them subject to some external forces that, you know, that may have a different agenda. Right. But if you ask the question, what then would be, you know, the relative basis of success, that is, whether colonial powers from outside will be able to overwhelm, for example, the argument of Lumumba from inside. Well, I would say that what Lumumba is fundamentally saying is he's appealing to us to say that, you know, there's a truth in us, there's a strength in us, and that if we depend upon that, we can get to places that, you know, that we couldn't reach otherwise. So that's a pretty powerful incentive. So I think that his message really is the winning message, because it turns out one of the concerns the Europeans have is that they've never been able to even live amongst themselves.
Right.
And so they actually need to know, to learn how to live like human beings, and that's what he's addressing. That's one of the reasons that I was just so pleased to hear, you know, that you introduced him to me. I'd never heard of him before. Is because one of the problems that happens with, in fact, Professor Lumumba, he addressed this, that what we tend to do is we tend to look at the world the way the European does. You remember Malesi Asante talked about Afrocentrism,
right?
This ideal of beginning our analysis from ourselves, right? Well, that's what Lumumba is telling us, right? And but one of the problems that happens when you get this kind of alienated consciousness, these black people who are looking at the world through white eyes and whatnot, is we start thinking our problem is what the white people think their problem was.
Right.
And one of the things Professor Lumumba talked about is he described, hold it, it's not about building tall buildings, it's about, you know, the quality of our lives and the things that are important to us. And so I think that, to your question succinctly, I think that, yes, there will be monkey wrenches put in by forces, you know, that are not interested in mm-hmm. black people being free. But I think that just his message is so powerful that it has the impact that the Europeans, it's sort of like, you know, somebody who, you know, you heard the story of the hunter getting caught by the game.
Right.
That, in other words, you intended to do one thing, but when you heard it was so good, you decided, oh, I think I want to get with this program.
Right.
So
exactly.
I think that Lumumba's got a message that will be taken back to Europe to show them how to live as human beings.
That's exactly. Let me ask you this question, and then I want Brother Timothy to address it as well from his perspective. Do you buy the argument that Gaddafi was killed and targeted for death because he was creating a new currency? And let me tell you why I asked that. Because as I understand how that could be implemented into a system, there wasn't enough stuff there to do that. He didn't have enough involvement outside of himself, maybe in Syria or somewhere like that would have agreed to that. My thought was And that's what we see being played out right now in the world, is that Gaddafi was moving to unite Africa militarily, and that the whole issue with Chad, because if you again look at a map of Chad, Chad has tons of uranium. And to be able to get into Chad and get that uranium and build a bomb, which is what we're seeing done now in Iran, and which would have been done in Syria if they would not have created the civil war. And that way began to give some of those African independent nations a little bit more power through weaponry. Because very clearly, you and I talked about it earlier today, you got to bring weaponry into the game here somewhere. You know, I mean, all of this talk about getting together and all that, but these folks don't operate like that. They operate on guns. And somewhere you would have to address that. So can you address that from your perspective?
Well. One, I would answer yes, that no question that that's the reason for Saddam Hussein's death, and that's the reason for Hugo Chavez's death. That these were people, you know, who were looking at alternative financial systems.
Okay.
Well, but the problem though is that, you know, if you don't, in other words, if you're going to play the gangster game, and that's what Gaddafi was attempting to play, then you've got to have gangster means. And so, you know, and that's, you know, so yeah, I would argue that yes, that's what happened. Now there was some other part to that. I thought. Oh, but one thing, you know, while I'm collecting that, Timothy was talking about the fact of what the police are doing, despite the fact that there's a black police chief. Well, I'm reminded of Barbara Sizemore. Now, you might remember her. She was, I believe, the first black principal in the Philadelphia school.
Oh, yeah, Barbara
Sizemore. She was also in Chicago, and she was also in D.C. And she talked about how blacks were played out of pocket, because what they would do is that there would be a black head, but the administration, the people who actually implement the policy, would be white. And they would be essentially undermining all the policy, so you'd end up with a result which would be harmful to black people, but it would be blamed on the black person who would be the head. It was almost like you saw it with Wilson Good, you know, as the mayor, and, right. You know, he certainly didn't authorize for them to drop a bomb on his own people, but it happened anyway.
So. Yeah, exactly. Okay, let me ask, Mr. Ayan is back. Mr. Ayan, did you have a comment you wanted to add into this discussion of Africa and community development, of the similarities of the struggle of Africa and the black communities here in America?
No, short comment, and I want to say good evening, brothers. How's everybody?
Good evening.
Good. And thanks for this, Doc. This is excellent. I love PLO Lumumba. You know, I'm a big believer in self-examination, and if you're in a continuous problem, then at some point you've got to look at yourself, whether it's a single person or a group.
Right.
And I think about this a lot. Like, why is it that Africans get, you know, but shitted on, I just have to say what I feel, shitted on by everybody.
Right.
You know, you mentioned the Arabs, you know, of course, Europeans, Chinese are in there. I mean, they're just doing, you know, just overtaking, oppressing.
Right.
And why is it that we keep being in this position? I think that's
yeah,
in terms of getting to the root of a problem. We have got to look at that.
You got to.
And so you were talking about that in the beginning, and I just said, yeah, that's right on. So, you know, in studying African spiritual systems, one of the things that I've learned is that Africans, we have had an issue with tribalism forever. You know,
right.
That's, tribalism has been a barrier for us. So Africa is not perfect. That was one of our issues that we need to take a close look at.
Right.
And it has to be you know, destroyed. We can't afford to suffer from tribalism anymore. We've got to be one Africa. And that's going to take a lot of undoing of in some indigenous African culture and then the Europeanized mind of the African.
That's right.
So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I also think that I am I insist at this point, at least in my own spirit, that we as an African people do less talking, conventions, conferences, and whatnot, and do more strategizing.
Right.
Because we talk so much about, you know, what's going on with us and what needs to be done. But as I watch us, there's more talk and less strategy. While, you know, the devil is terrorizing the world, is I always say this, they're 50, 100 steps ahead of us and strategizing on how to destroy us. So we really need to do more of that. And the other thing is that, you know, in terms of what's going on with us, that we keep, you know, we stay in subjugated by someone. You mentioned a long time ago, Doc, about African xenophilia.
Oh, right. Xenophobia. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
It's xenophilia, not phobia, but philia. Yeah, I think that's the term that's used.
Yeah,
and I would say, there's no such word, I don't think, but just dysfunction. You know, how do you keep welcoming people that keep crapping on you and stealing resources, et cetera, et cetera?
Right.
That is a problem in our mindset. If you look at remember the movie Django, and we talked about this before, when the guy in Candyland that had the Candyland was saying, looking at an African skull and saying that there's a submissive part of the brain of the African.
Yes, 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 yes.
We need to take a look at that.
Yeah, yeah.
Not because of what that idiot said, you know, of course it was just a movie, but we need to take a look at that.
Right.
I see that in my African brothers and sisters that are here. I see just a softness. Just kind of an agreement, I hate to use the word submissive, but a submissive nature. And I even was listening to this sister, one of the Aboriginals in Australia, and they were talking about how, you know, the Aboriginals are just being destroyed. They're just being annihilated in Australia.
Yeah, they sure are.
Just totally annihilated.
Totally.
And as they were interviewing one of the Aboriginal sisters, she said, well, we don't get angry. It's just not in our nature.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so as she said, as blacks, we don't get angry. We don't stay angry. We forgive. That's a part of the problem.
Right.
And we have to look at that. The masses, so many of the masses in Africa accepting Christianity and staying Christian even after all of the terrorism in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And the last part is we really need to look at thinking, and I think PLO Lumumba talked about this, that everything white we have to mimic.
Right.
We have to mimic democracy says who?
Yeah.
We have to mimic capitalism says who?
Yeah, and we think it's better. It's not.
Exactly. Those systems are destructive. Those systems are not ours. That's not the way. We actually had successful and great civilizations before they brought their sick culture. So, you know, we might want to take a look at going back to who we actually were before the Europeans started, you know, introducing their poison. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, and you're right, because and Dr. Clark talked about it too, because, you know, you're dealing with an ice culture, and there's a different mentality and process to living under conditions like that, as opposed to doing that. And, I mean, anthropologists and people have looked at it as a concept, you know, to really be considered, you know. They come out of an ice culture, and that's hostility. I think one of the great examples of explaining that was a movie that was done years ago. It was called Quest for Fire. And that was right on point. In terms of looking at coming out of an ice box and living under those kinds of conditions, right down to, you know, the survival of food, clothing, shelter. which is the bottom line. Mm-hmm.
And let me say this really quickly, because I think somebody may have made reference to this, but, you know, white women and white children were one of the first groups to be abused by European males before they got hold of everybody else. I mean, savage abuse.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Now, from what you're talking about, so our job as Africans is how do we deal with this? First of all, to take an honest look at that ice heart and that ice culture, how do we address it? Because it's not going to change.
No, it's
not. Oh, another quick thing.
It's part of their nature.
Yeah. Hmm?
It's part of their nature. Can't change.
Yeah, so what is our nature, and how do we make the proper adjustments so that we can handle that?
Right.
Ice nature. That's the piece that we've really got to deal with, address rather. And but there are Pan-African movements going on that are really great and show a lot of promise. I don't know if everybody heard the sister from, I think she's the ambassador from the African Union.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yes.
You know, she's telling the truth about how the African leader revolutionaries, you know, do get killed, and the ones that are in agreement, they stay alive,
yeah,
you know.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
But there is a Pan-Africanist movement that is beautiful that's going on. So that's a positive,
right,
you know, light in all of this,
exactly,
this insanity.
Exactly. And, I think very, very, very realistically, we have to, you know, open our third eyes to a lot of things that are happening and see how they operate. Like, I have a tendency, I like to watch the face of people when they're doing something and when they're going to their behavior. And if you get an opportunity, that conversation with the Ghanaian leader, the prime minister from France was standing right next to him. And if you look at it on YouTube, you should watch that prime minister's face when he's talking and explaining to him what he said and how he's, you know, how he's, the body language. And I look at body language. And then there's another one. Watch sometimes, because a lot of times now with the video cameras and the iPhone videos, watch when they video a police officer manhandling an African person. It's like a mad dog. It's like a wolf. It's a wolf nature. And they take it. It's like an aggression. Like when that guy, the incident that just recently happened in Phoenix with the young girl, her daughter took a doll out of the store. And the cops manhandled her. And watch his face as he's doing it, as he kicked her in her leg. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things we have to look at. Brother Timothy, I want to ask you something. I mean, this fits right into our discussion. The Nation of Islam has often proposed the idea of separation from the Euro world. And even in their area of developing a nation, and the Nation of Islam, and which means independently ruled and controlled and living under their own understanding of things as opposed to the influences from outside. But at the same time, in doing that, that did not stop the political perpetrators of controlled and domination community from coming in and still disrupting that light. As witnessed in those cases where they were poisoning those farms and doing some of the things of the leaders and creating dissension, and some of those things that we saw, even with the thing with Brother Malcolm, him being assassinated and making it look like the nation did it, and, you know, just it's all of those things. What do you think is a way? Is that now still favorably looked at as a policy? To pull away and separate and create our own nation from somewhere else? Is that still an idea that the nation promotes?
Yes, I'm going to say two things to you, Dr. Rogers, and I'm happy to have your guests on, like Mr. Pugh and my brother from Jamaica and his sister down south and the brother who calls in and everybody else. Happy to have all y'all on because I learned from all of you. But I'm going to say this, let's start with what you said about the separation piece. Now, and Message of the Black Man, which is in another room amongst a lot of books I have, I got to dig it up. He talks about the program. He talks about the economic program. He also talks about the separation. So he has some people in the nation first coming in, or some people who are not in the nation, who would ask questions like that. They said, well, Tim, if you separate, you still have to go to him for the resource. And they would mix up separation with segregation. There's a difference between separation and segregation.
Right.
Now, when you talk about, yes, they did. They poisoned his cattle. Yes, they did. They did a lot of things to the nation. And Malcolm was assassinated. And it's an idea that could come into fruition. It's like the Brown case. The Brown case was run with Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Mason as an experiment to what was to come. Was it successful to some people? Some people said they didn't like the integrated part. But what was going on before the integrated part? Both of them experiments that would have been successful. They could have been successful if they were implemented.
Right.
Now, I'm going to tell you, there were two. These are the people that I miss so much. I was living when Mun Man was here. And that's Elijah Muhammad. I miss him. I miss Marcus Garvey. I had never met him. I wasn't this time. And Booker T. Washington. And I miss Elijah Muhammad because I was living when the nation split, 75. Unfortunately, he left us.
Right.
74. Before that, it was Elijah Muhammad. He was the total embodiment of the movement. My thing was is that when it came to Elijah Muhammad, he had connections internationally that people did not know. Two of his most supported people that gave him what he wanted, he got a lot of things that he wanted. Was Shukrano, Indonesia, and Gaddafi. Did you know Gaddafi gave him money for Mas Marianne?
I'm sorry, you asked me a question?
No. I said he had connections with people who gave him what he wanted, and okay. They were two people. They were Shukrano from Indonesia and Gaddafi.
Okay.
Gaddafi gave him money for Mas Marianne. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah, I knew about it.
Okay, my point was is that Gaddafi has been a friend to the nation. There's a person that I hate today. And I when I went in the booth, I had to close my eyes and hold my breath and push the button for her. I voted for Hover Trump. She's the reason why Gaddafi's dead is Hillary Clinton. I hate her.
Okay.
They disarmed that man.
Yeah.
You're right. He wanted a monetary system. He wanted to do his with his oil money. He wanted to do what he had to do with education. And he wanted to unite Africa. He really wanted to help black people of color.
Right.
You're exactly right. And they disarmed him. And Obama went with it.
Right. Let me just let you know, you got about 2 minutes.
But I'm leaving it at that because that's where I'm at with that. After, right. Well, we got to move on.
Right.
He's not around anymore, and we're happy we're here. But a man like that, seems like every time we get a couple inches up, we get pushed back in.
Right. Right. That's right. Okay. Unfortunately, I wanted to give you a little bit more time to talk about it, but we're right at our closing time, and they don't give us much time over our schedule go off time. Sometimes I had a little play area that doesn't happen anymore. So they cut us off right at 10:02. So I want to thank you all that were here and appreciate your comments. This requires additional discussion and ideas, and we're going to come back and talk about this economic situation because it's very demanded and it's very important for us. In particular, it's important as we think about our own communities. So I wish we had more time, but we don't. Thank you so much, all of you that participated, our listening audience. We will be back next week, same time, on Time for an Awakening. Thank you. Have a good week. In Africa.
what a shame.